You know, Carl, if you have not read The Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv, out about 10 years now, bestseller, yes. One of the most phenomenal books. The premise is this. We are fast approaching a time, Carl, when your little girl and other little girls and boys will have never spent a single moment out in the outdoors. I mean, that to me is just extraordinary. So our guest is Richard Louv. It's the 10th anniversary of that book, Last Child. And as I understand it, Algonquin, the publisher, has redesigned the cover. And Richard, you have updated the foreword or the afterword, whatever you want to call it. To what are you saying there?
The afterword is about the movement that has emerged since Last Child in the Woods was published that you've been involved with yourself.
Correct.
Basically, when the book came out, I imagined a movement in the second of the last chapter, and that was wishful thinking. But once the book came out, people began to talk about what I called nature deficit disorder, which was not a known medical diagnosis. Maybe it should have been, but should still be, but it's a metaphor. And people had a language to talk about this thing they'd been feeling for a long time. So I was quickly overwhelmed with requests to, what do we do now? So some good people banded around me, including yourself, and Children in Nature Network, a nonprofit, was created, and really a grassroots movement has emerged that now is in every state in the union. It's in several other countries, all to get kids outdoors at every level.
Are you pleased with the result of the 10 years of your action and the Children in Nature Network action?
Well, I am. Is it enough? No. We're far from finished with the job, but a lot has taken place. I think there is a lot more awareness now about not only the gap between children and nature, but I think even more importantly, this body of research, which keeps expanding, which is fairly new, only in the last decade or so, that shows the health benefits, the psychological benefits, the physical health, as well as the cognitive functioning benefits, the ability to learn, be creative. All of those things come from being outside in nature more, not only for kids, but for adults. In the second book I did, The Nature Principle, is more about adults, that this affects us too.
Well, I think it's very important for both adults and children to be outdoors, and I think I'm not sure, what do you think the cause has been to keep so many of adults and even children inside over the last, let's say, decade?
Well, there are several things. One, obviously, is electronics. There's a lot of competition for time now. I don't demonize video games, though, because I think there are larger issues even than that. One of them is fear of strangers. Largely, that has been created by the news media, my profession, as well as entertainment media. We believe that, you know, there's a boogeyman on every corner, and some neighborhoods are dangerous, but most of them are safer than they've ever been. The actual number of violent crimes toward children outside the home has been going down for 30 or 40 years. What's been going up is the 24-hour news coverage. So that's one of the big ones. Parents really are scared, and I understand that because I felt that as a parent too. Another one is just bad urban planning. People get preached to all the time, go out, take a walk. Walk where in some of these neighborhoods? I mean, there's even a Starbucks within walking distance. And parks, many of the neighborhoods, particularly urban neighborhoods, there's no parks, there's no safe parks. So those issues as well. And this permeates generationally. We're now in the first generation of denatured parents, essentially, parents who grew up without very much nature in their lives. So even when they know about the great benefits of this, they don't know where to start, which is why we've been working on creating family nature clubs and all kinds of new ways to connect to nature.
Richard, Carl Sabatino here. And Roland knows how I feel about this. I have been a proponent through my family's not-for-profit work in the following statement, and I'd like to get your reaction to it. Yes, people should be out and enjoying the beauty of the outdoors wherever. However, the statement reads as follows: what nature and wildlife require is man's absence, not our participation. Give me your thoughts on that, please.
I don't agree with that. I understand what you're saying. Some places people should not be in those.
How do we differentiate places where they should and should not be?
How sensitive the native habitat is. Also, I mean, there are ways to measure how much we damage nature when we're in. The problem is, and many wildlife biologists said the same thing when we were starting out. Many of them, maybe most, have changed their mind. If we're going to protect nature, where is the future constituency going to come from for endangered species? If kids never learn to love nature, if they never feel that it's theirs, there's that issue too. And also the other issue is, it's arrogant as a species for us to think we're separate from nature. We're part of nature.
Oh, without question. And frankly, not as smart about it as some of our fauna friends, if they could speak, would tell us. I think we're quite ignorant about it in general. There are those who love it, but you can also love something to death. I do agree with you that participation in nature for children and for the next generation is vitally important. It's a learning curve. It's learning about our part in it, not our mastery of it. Does that make better sense?
And one of the ways to deal with that is, I agree that there are many places that should be protected. One of the problems is that those areas are smaller and smaller. So one of the ideas of the Nature Principle, the second book, is it's no longer enough to conserve. Conservation is no longer enough. Even if we conserve every square inch of wilderness we've still got, it won't be enough for the biodiversity we need. And I think we should preserve that. So if conservation is no longer enough, now we need to create nature. That means in our cities. As of 2008, more people in the world live in cities than in the countryside, first time in human history. That means one or two things. Either human beings will continually lose whatever contact they have with nature, and they will no longer value it. Or it means the beginning of a new kind of city. Urban parks with the highest biodiversity turn out to be the parks with the greatest positive impact on human psychological health. Our cities could become engines of biodiversity. If we begin to change our yards into native species, green roofs, there's lots of ways to do that through design. So in essence, we're creating nature around us rather than going feeling we have to travel 100 miles and then overpopulate a national park.
I would agree with that totally, Richard. In fact, that was going to be one of my follow-up questions about the city parks versus rural wilderness. In this city in particular, in New York City, where we are broadcasting from today, they has one of the most magnificent parks in the world. The New York Central Park, created by Frederick Law Olmsted, the same guy who designed Yosemite.
That's correct,
Carl.
Mm-hmm.
If you spend some time, you can feel the totality of nature in Central Park.
Yes, you can.
If you get yourself down on the ground,
that's correct.
If you look under leaves, if you look behind the rocks, not just out in the ballpark.
Absolutely correct.
And
yes.
On a little boat.
Yes. And I've done it.
Yeah.
And it used to be our nature walk. Also, Brooklyn's magnificent, magnificent park, also designed by the same individual. And also a magnificent monument to what urban planning can do if done properly.
You want to comment on urban planning there, please, Richard?
Well, we forgot. I mean, Frederick Law Olmsted knew something. The industrialists of New York City knew something when they hired him to create Central Park. And they weren't doing it because it would create a nice view. They were doing it because they knew it would make their workers more productive. It was an economic decision. Then we forgot that kind of urban planning. I mean, urban planning at the turn of the last century, they actually counted the number of steps that a family should have to walk to get to a neighborhood park. And that was all about health. It was the Healthy Cities Movement. That was the beginning of the last century. Then we forgot that, and we created unlivable suburbs, many of them. unlivable cities. We now live in the kinds of cities and suburbs that you get neither the benefits of being in an urban area or the benefits of being in a rural area. You get kind of a mix of both, and there's no place to walk often. There's, you know, there's not enough nature.
Richard, I want you to hold your thought on that because I want to come back to you. Let's pause for just a moment or two and stay with us because I want to talk to you about what you would say to the entire world about the nature movement if, in fact, you could speak to every single one of them. Hold on. Stay with us.
Please do, Richard. Call Sabatino with Roland Smith. This is Smith Sabatino, America Weekend, on the Envision Radio Network.
America Weekend, Weekend, Weekend.
Think green. Harrison with you. Did you know that polar bears are now green, but not necessarily by choice? Turns out the fur of white polar bears is turning green in Japan, where the bears have been brought in as zoo animals. At Japan's Higashiyama Zoo and Botanical Gardens, the polar bear's fur changed color after swimming in a pond with seemingly unstoppable overgrowth of algae. Climate change and fluctuating temperatures and infrequent water changes, all due to the zoo's conservation efforts, have caused explosive algae growth in the polar bear pond and safety moat. To restore bear fur from green to white, zookeepers had to scrub slimy algae off. Not so easy since it's live bears you're trying to scrub. The Japanese zoo polar bears will likely rotate from green to white and back as a natural result of new challenges from an ever-changing climate. From the Greeniverse.
Think Green with Harrison at thinkgreenradio.com.
Where are they now with Ahmad Rashad?
This Heisman finalist obliterated the college record books in 1990, throwing for 5,100 yards and 54 touchdowns, more than his entire NFL career. So where is David Klinger now? David's pro career had few highlights, but it helped lead him to his life's path. During his NFL days, David was encouraged by his Bible class teacher to pursue a career in religious studies. David earned his PhD in Old Testament studies from the Dallas Theological Seminary, and in 2010 was named the director of its Houston campus.
Klinger zings it in the end zone, caught for the touchdown.
David Klinger, from play caller to true calling. I'm Ahmad Rashad.
The Movie Man 6-second review starts now.
Ex Machina is a smart, cool, stylish, great-looking movie. Hashtag sexy robot, the meat.
6-second reviews are brought to you by Marvel's Avengers, Age of Ultron. Now playing in theaters.